time for Coffee with the Chicken Ladies, a podcast for people who love chickens.
Hey, everybody, and welcome. It's Chrissy and Holly from Coffee with the Chicken Ladies. We're here, and this is episode number 174 of our podcast, where we talk about everything chicken, family, fun, and
more chickens.
More chickens. We drink a ton of coffee. I'm talking a ton. But most importantly,
we hug chickens every day.
And we kiss them too. Don't forget. We brew coffee from a little coffee house in historic Gettysburg, PA. Phantom Coffee Roasters. Holly Ann, what kind of coffee are we brewing today?
Oh, we're back to the Guatemalan coffee today. And it's delicious.
Where can everybody get their Guatemalan coffee?
PhantomRoasters.com.
And use the code FluffyButt for 10% off the entire website. It's a great code. Go use it and follow them on Facebook and Instagram. Are you ready to sip some of this amazing Guatemalan coffee and chat?
I am. But first, a word from our sponsor.
We have some exciting news to share from our sponsor, Grubly Farms. They're here, new and improved, Grubly's World Harvest.
I'm a longtime subscriber, and my flock love the healthy, nutritious treats, plus orders $40 and more ship free.
If you haven't heard, Grubly's has a fantastic layer pellet and crumble feed. It's packed with plant and insect protein, perfect for those picky chickens and ducks.
Grubly Farms makes food and treats for healthy pets and planet.
To support us and Grubly's, go to our website or our show notes and use the link. Try it today.
Chick season is here. And right now, you can try NatureWise Chick Starter Grower Feed and save $10. It's all the nutrition your chicks need in one feed. Click on the link in this week's show notes and get $10 off today.
Okay, so how are you doing?
I'm all right over here. How about you?
I'm okay. I'm hanging in. I am really, really tired. So we had a fantastic time at Cooptastic. This is the first time we've been on the mic since then. And it was such an adventurous trip and so much fun. Let's do it all again next year. Come on.
It was super fun. Yeah. I really would like to see an even bigger turnout next year. We made so many great connections, got to listen to some great talks. And the 4-H complex is absolutely beautiful. 200 acres in this beautiful lodge and hotel. It was gorgeous.
It was absolutely gorgeous. Although there was a lot of controlled burning going around the 200 acres. And the Wi-Fi lines were burned.
Okay, maybe we didn't have any Wi-Fi. And maybe it was a little smoky here and there, but that lake view was still great.
It was fantastic at Cooptastic. So yeah, we planned on doing bunches of stories and posting and interviewing people while we were there. Well, sometimes things take a little side turn. And we had no Wi-Fi for the entire weekend, so we were forced to just enjoy our company, and it actually ended up to be really a fun, fun time.
It was great.
Yeah, it was a really fun trip. Now, I do want to talk about something that happened to me right before I went, and it's hard for me to even get through it a little bit, but everyone that watches us on social medias will know that I post Bubbles, the matriarch of my flock, a lot on there in her run. Well, the day before we went to Cooptastic, Bubbles collapsed and died. And she was 10 and she lived an amazing life. But for 10 years, she said good morning to me every morning and I will miss her so much. So I just wanted to put that out there so that everybody knew kind of what happened.
She is a very special hen. And I got to tell you, I would like to go the way Bubbles went. Digging in the dirt in the sunshine, and then the next moment you're gone. That's what you could hope for.
It was a beautiful day. She was fine in the morning. You and I were on the phone. She was taking the oyster shell and throwing it everywhere. She was walking around. She was eating all day. And she was right next to a hole where she was digging. And she was one of the best hens I've ever known. For 10 years, she never bullied a single hen. She never had an unhealthy day. And I miss her already so much in there because
it's very, very hard to lose the special. It's hard to lose all of them. But the ones that you have for their whole life, I mean, you don't replace them.
No.
You know, you love all of your chickens, but you don't replace them. They hold a special place in your heart forever.
Yeah, Mama Bubbles, we won't be seeing her anymore on social media. And so everyone who follows us closely and listens to us on here, I just wanted to let them know what happened. She did go in a way that everybody dreams of going, doing mm-hmm. something you love and just being here 1 second and not the next.
Yep.
And it's just hard for the people you leave behind, right? So, yeah.
Right.
But I was very thankful to have her in my life for 10 years.
Yeah.
Very, very thankful.
Very special girl. Yeah.
It was kind of good to then go away for a few days and not have Wi-Fi.
It was so strange. At first, it was like we couldn't do anything we needed to do. I had a bunch of emails to send and I had a lot of stuff to read through. And I was like, well, guess I really am on vacation this weekend.
Exactly. Exactly. So that was really a good thing. So I enjoyed not being able to do anything just for those few days, except for enjoy the people that we were with, you know, enjoy that time with them.
Yeah, we made some new friendships and just had a fantastic time.
And you will be hearing some of them on the show coming up.
Yes, you will. Yes,
we will not say who, but we do have some interviews that will be lining up for you guys that you're going to love. So on that note, if you're listening to our show and you're loving it, head on over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a written review. It does amazing things for the growth of our show. While you're there, hit that subscribe button. It's another great way to help us grow. They count them. Now, if you listen to us on Spotify, you know you can leave us a 5-star rating over there. You just go to the About page, hit the 5-star, because they count those ratings too. And believe it or not, it's a completely free way to help us grow.
We've had some listeners leave us comments on Spotify, which is really great too.
Love it. Keep them coming.
If you're looking for other ways to help support the podcast, you can tell some chicken-loving friends about us. You can share your favorite episodes on social media. You can visit our Etsy shop, mugs, t-shirts, tiny chickens. You can become a patron of the show, patreon.com/coffeewiththechickenladies. An enormous thank you to all of our patrons. We appreciate your support more than we can tell you. The other way you can help support the show is visit our website and our show notes, use our affiliate links and discount codes, and buy products from our sponsors.
Yay!
Hey, Chris.
Yeah.
Do you like subscription boxes?
Does it have anything to do with chickens?
Of course.
Then yeah. Let me take a minute to tell you about the Chicken Love Box. If you love goodies for your chickens and you need to go to chickenlove.com.
I love the Mega Box. Tons of useful products for my flock and a chicken tea for me.
You can't go wrong with a chicken tea. They are so cute and so soft.
In the February box, I absolutely love the spray bottle of Bye Bye Boo Boos and the Rooster Cheese Spreader Knife.
I love the Chicken Lady Era hat and tee. They're great, and you can't go wrong with that coffee with the Chicken Lady's mug.
Boxes start at $39 a month. They ship immediately after your order, and shipping is always free.
Such a great deal. Don't wait. Get off the nest and click already. Use the code CWTCL50 for 50% off your first box of a 3-month subscription or more. That's chickenlove.com. That's chickenluv.com. Get your subscription today.
Have you heard of Strong Animals Chicken Essentials? They make natural supplements for your flock.
Strong Animals has used plant-based products and natural approaches to promote the health and vitality of backyard flocks. Their products contain organic essential oils, prebiotics, and other natural ingredients to support the immune system and digestive health. Give your chicks and chickens what they need to thrive with Strong Animals health products. Visit GetStrongAnimals.com today.
The Breed Spotlight is brought to you by Murray McMurray Hatchery, defining quality for generations. For over a century, Murray McMurray Hatchery has remained a trusted family-owned business, working tirelessly to ensure our poultry meet the highest standards.
Whether you are an experienced enthusiast or just embarking on the journey, look to McMurray Hatchery for guaranteed quality rare and heritage breeds, low minimums, and all the supplies you need to raise your flock. Request a free catalog today. Da, 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 da. Walk like an Egyptian. Da, 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 da. Walk like an Egyptian. Now it's time for this week's Breed Spotlight.
Okay, you got me with that one. I did not expect that. That was good.
This week's Breed Spotlight is
the Egyptian Fayumi. I can't even say it now. The Egyptian Fayumi.
And you're going to walk like an Egyptian Fayumi too.
Yes, you can't walk like an Egyptian Fayumi, but you have got to be pretty fast.
Oh, yeah. You got to walk like an Egyptian Fayumi. Da, 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 da. So yeah, that was a really cool song back in the day in our ages.
Was that the Bangles?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I was just outside a little while ago taking photos of Delilah, the Egyptian Fayumi, because she was digging a gigantic and super deep crater out in the rum.
Well, yeah, that's what they do. That's what Lucy does too.
The beautiful Egyptian Fayumi is a very old breed of chicken developed in Fayum, which is a province that lies west of the Nile River and south of Cairo, Egypt's capital city. While they are not APA accepted, the Fayumis are considered a Mediterranean breed.
You know we love those Mediterraneans.
Love them, love them. And we've said this before on the show. Even though a bird may not be APA accepted, we still loosely group them in the class that makes the most sense for them geographically and history-wise as well.
Right.
Fayumis are light-bodied, very, very heat-hardy, and quite disease-resistant.
They do have that reputation, the disease resistance, for sure.
Yeah. They are most definitely a heritage breed, not necessarily a U.S. heritage breed. And while they are rare here in the U.S., they are reasonably plentiful in some other parts of the world. Now, I wanted to learn a little bit more about the place where they were from, and it was really fascinating. So the area of Fayum is well known for its Egyptian cultural artifacts and also for this incredibly gorgeous, lush oasis.
Oh.
Yeah, the area, it's made up of desert, as well as a very large lake and several waterfalls. And this water supplies the Fayum Oasis, which is the largest oasis in the world.
Okay, so let's go visit their hometown.
Oh, after the stuff I saw, I would love to visit there. This area, the Fayum Oasis, has long been famous for its fruit orchards, its vegetable production, and for a very pretty little chicken breed.
Well, if it's got fruit orchards and apple trees, you better go.
I mean, a lot of its palm trees, I'm imagining, is probably date palms, and I love dates.
I was going to say, if there's some heritage apple breeds over there, you're already there.
I don't know that you can grow apple trees there, but yes, I would be. It's true, I would be there. For what it's worth, though, this is for you. For what it's worth, the Romans did spend a big chunk of time here in Egypt.
They did. That's right? I mean, being an Italian, you know that.
You know this.
Well, a lot of times if people do the DNA testing now and they'll say there's Middle Eastern kind of thrown in, even Egyptian, you know, somewhere in the Middle East thrown in their DNA because of the Romans traveling.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Well, the Romans called Fayum Crocodilopolis, and I'm not making that up. And it's because there were a lot of crocodiles there. So they called it Crocodilopolis.
Well, yeah, that makes sense.
It also reminds me of you.
Well, yeah. I would be doing the same thing, that's for sure.
I know, Crocodilopolis, yes. The Romans also caused a lot of trouble there because they forced the Egyptians to switch from the fruit and vegetable production to grain production. And then they demanded that all the grain come to them, the Romans, exclusively.
Well, you know we like our pasta. Come on.
The Romans had to conquer the world because they needed material for pasta.
That's right. That's right.
But the people and, of course, the chickens persisted. And in time, the Romans went home and the Egyptians went back to their beautiful oasis.
And let me guess, they took the chickens with them.
I don't think they did.
They didn't take the Egyptian Fayumis with them?
You think they took the Fayumi with them? Maybe that's where the Sicilian buttercup comes from. Maybe the Sicilian buttercup was a golden Fayumi.
Maybe. I mean, they kind of resemble each other a bit. And, you know, I mean,
quite a bit. They do quite a bit. Yeah.
The Romans don't go anywhere and not take the chickens home with them.
I know.
Come on.
It's true. I wondered about that. I didn't see anything. But also, this is an area like where would you have to do the research to find the answer to that? You know what I mean?
Right.
Now, because this breed is so old and so incredibly hardy, they have gained a reputation for excellent disease resistance. Among other things, they're known to be resistant to both Merrick's disease and Newcastle disease.
Which is great, but if you still have the opportunity to get that vaccine, do it.
Well, I did. I had Zara and Delilah vaccinated.
Yeah.
Because why not?
Exactly. Just be safe. Better safe than sorry, for sure.
That's what I was thinking. Now, in the early 1940s, the Dean of Agriculture of the University of Iowa imported silver Fayumi eggs from Egypt and hatched them, establishing a Fayumi flock at the university that, believe it or not, remains there to this day.
Yeah, I remember this from way back in the very beginning when we talked about Egyptian fiumes.
Now, early on, a lot of the researchers at the university were crossing the fiumes with American birds, probably trying to create chickens that retain the fiumes' disease resistance. The Iowa blue was likely a result of some of these experiments.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, the projects didn't have any great standout success with these crosses for whatever reason. I mean, I guess if you want all the Fiume characteristics, you just need a Fiume.
Yeah, exactly. But we've talked about this whole part in the Egyptian Fiume one that we did way back. And also in, when we talk about Iowa blue, because they are in the mix of the Iowa blue, basically. Yeah. So I remember all of this. I mean, a bird that has disease resistance the way they do, you definitely want to try to spread that well, that's for sure.
Why there are so many studies involving the Turkin right now, because Turkin is also very disease resistant.
Oh, yeah. Very.
Now, the Fiumes arrived in the UK in the 1980s. The UK is lucky because they have both the gold and silver penciled varieties.
They do. The gold's really pretty.
Yeah.
These birds, and we call them beautiful little birds because they are very small. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the roosters are weighing in around 4.5 pounds, and the hens are coming in at about 3.5 pounds. So think about that. They're one step away from a bantam, basically.
They are the most petite birds in my flock, except the bantams. Yeah.
I was going to say, they're in between like a leghorn and bantams in weight. So if you're smaller than a leghorn and you're a wee bit bigger than a bantam, you kind of have your own class.
Yeah.
Here in the U.S., we do have the silver penciled variety, which they're really pretty. And a lot of people seem to think they look like seagulls.
We have been known to call our birds the seagulls, yes.
So they have white heads and necks with their body feathers covered in narrow bands of dark penciling. Okay. They're really, really pretty. So you're going to quickly notice, you know, the resemblance to several other small, older breeds, like the silver penciled Hamburg, the Campine, and even the Death Layer, because those eyes go right through you in these breeds. I'm going to tell you that.
And they, like, they have small body, narrow penciling. They're, you know,
and these
silver and gold.
Huge dark eyes. All those chickens have that too.
I know. They draw you in. It's like Betty Davis eyes. They're like, come hither.
To me, even more than the penciling, the eyes stand out as a trait of this bird. And if you look up pictures or if you know you see one, you're going to know what I'm talking about. It's like they stare into your soul. They're like the Death Eater on Harry Potter. You're like, let me look into your soul. These very, very large, dark eyes. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, they have the straight combs because, of course, they're Mediterraneans, and red earlobes. While they have the willow green. Listen, willow green is the preferred leg color. Blue legs also occur. Now, if I get an Egyptian fiume, which I'm going to tell you, it's probably not going to happen. I want mine to have the willow green legs because that's really different.
Well, Zara, and we lost Zara a few months back, sudden death, which we actually think was shock. Zara did have willow green legs. Delilah has blue legs.
Right.
Which is beautiful, but the green is much more unusual.
Yeah. Okay. So as in every Mediterranean, the tail is very vertical, giving them a jaunty look. Mm-hmm. It's a little jaunty.
A little jaunty girl.
I don't know if I want to be known as the jaunty girl. I'm jaunty.
Those chickens are bad. They'll be jaunty.
Okay. So there is no breed standard in the U.S. Okay. But there is one in the UK. And this is a great resource for anybody in the US interested in breeding Fiumes. So you can get your hands on the breed standard for the UK and you can kind of guide yourself through with breeding them that way. Now, here we go. We know we have a Mediterranean. We know we have a very tiny bird. Let's look at the egg numbers. Now, they're not going to be as high as you think.
No.
So hens are going to lay around 180 to 200 of the small white or creamy pearl colored eggs per year. Not bad, but not in that high level Mediterranean number that you're used to seeing.
No, I mean, if you have a pair of them, they're going to give you good numbers of eggs, but it definitely is not what you're going to expect from, say, a leghorn.
Right.
It's still a good number, you know.
And the other thing is this number will go down as with every chicken over time. You will have less eggs per year. So families generally do not go broody. Mediterraneans generally do not go broody.
I'm just going to hazard a guess here and tell you that if a Fayumi was a mother, they would not be very good mothers.
I mean, like, you're out. See ya. Good luck. Good luck to you.
Get out of here, kid.
Like, I'll see you around the table sometime. Like, I'll see you around the water bowl. And that's most Mediterraneans. When they lay an egg, the egg comes out, they walk away, and that is it.
That's it.
So you're going to need an incubator if you want to hatch. This is not going to be your broody hen.
Definitely not.
No, no, no.
Fayumis, in my opinion, are maybe not the best choice for beginning chicken keepers. They are loud. They are opinionated. They are flighty. They're occasionally bitey. They are occasional bullies. And they are absolutely miserable in the cold.
Like you just said, they're a chicken. And they're not cuddly. They don't have a reputation for being that huggable kind of chicken.
They really aren't. I mean, and Delilah's what, 3 going on 4?
Yeah.
She will let me scoop her up every now and again if I want to. She's still very friendly. I mean, both of the girls have always wanted to be around me when I was in the run with them. I will also say this. Fayumis are reasonably predator savvy, but they are not predator proof. And they fly very well, so watch out for tree roosting.
They're tiny. They can get air, and they can go up. I mean, you don't want to be trying to get chickens out of a tree at night. So
especially not these chickens. When I said they're loud, I wasn't kidding. They will scream if someone's in their nest box. They will scream if they want something. They will scream if you pick them up. They scream a lot. They have a lot to say.
So here's a good thing about them. If you're in an area, say, that's super humid and hot, like Florida or somewhere in the South, and this might be a good chicken for you, a different breed, but very heat hardy.
Oh, yeah.
And they're tiny with big combs and wattles, so they can really deal with that heat and humidity really well.
They do get through hot weather with very little trouble. This is what I think. I think that this is a hen for the connoisseur who loves chickens and all of their forms and all of their personalities and does not get offended when a hen flips them the middle toe.
Which they'll do.
Because they will.
This and then look at you with those big eyes. Like,
right? Like, what you gonna do about it?
Yeah, exactly.
This is a bird with serious attitude. They're super active. They love to scratch and dig. Like I just said, Delilah was outside just digging a canal in the run.
Yeah, they love to dig.
My girls do very well in our large aviary style run with a top on it and plenty of space to keep them busy. And they're small birds. So an area that's really big, they can run around in there.
Right. They're pro at dust bathing, excellent foragers. And most importantly, they're a beautiful bird with a really spicy personality. Let's just put it that way.
That's a good way to put it. They are spicy little birds.
You have to be ready for this. And this bird may not be a great family bird. This might be a great bird for someone who really wants to get into different breeds that is going to be okay with the lack of snuggle, huggle, and all the good stuff that way.
There's not a lot of snuggle and huggle with Fayumis. No. This, I will say, we had handled our Fayumis from the time they were a day old. We can pick them up and treat them, medicate them, etc., if necessary.
Right.
That's a prerequisite for all of our birds. They will be handled. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. But in general, they're quite independent. And the enjoyment with Fayumis is just really from watching them.
Right.
The interactions you have are not going to be like a coach and he's going to stand on your feet until you pick her up for a hug.
Right.
She might run up to you and yell for a treat and then run away. And you just have to be okay with that. You have to enjoy them. These are a bird, like I said, chicken connoisseur, who really is not offended by a bird that just doesn't give a damn about them.
Well, on that note, where can we tell everybody to go find them? Because we're just painting this glorious picture of this bird that everybody is going to want to have one.
I am being honest because I don't want anyone to get this bird with the wrong idea.
Oh, yeah. You got to be honest with what you know. And the things that we're saying, or we're not just saying, they're out there. They're very well documented.
It's true. McMurray Hatchery carries a beautiful line of Egyptian Fayumis, and some of their genetics are from that original University of Iowa flock.
Yeah. So, I mean, McMurray's the place to go for all your birds, especially these Egyptian Fayumis. They are a rare addition, and they will be the talk of the chicken flock. When people come over and see them, they're going to be like, when did you get a seagull? Yeah.
I love my Fayumis. I definitely will replace Zara at some point. I never want to be without them. I love everything about them.
Exactly. So if you're out there and you have the Egyptian Fayumi, send us some pictures or mention us in your story. Hit the mention button, because if you don't, sometimes if you just tag us, it comes over and we can like it, but we can't reshare it. Right. So hit the mention button, put our name in. That way we can reshare you and share your pictures. We want to see them.
If you're looking for a chicken coop that's produced in a planet-friendly, sustainable way, try Nestera.
Each coop is made from highly durable, 100% recycled plastic that keeps the equivalent of up to 2,000 shampoo bottles out of a landfill.
Their clean, modern design will fit into any garden or run area and comes with an industry-beating 25-year warranty and a range of handy accessories.
Simple to put together, so quick and easy to clean, and most importantly, red mite resistant. Your chickens will love it.
Quick shipping from Nestera.us.
For a 5% discount, use the affiliate link in our show notes, on our website, and on Instagram. Link in bio. Check them out today. Roosties proudly sponsors Coffee with the Chicken Ladies. They're back with an innovative new product. You're going to want to check this out.
It's an extra large set, a 14-pound feeder in 3-gallon water with steep anti-roost lids. They're made of super durable material. You can either stand them on legs or hang them on brackets on your coop or fence. They're easy to remove and clean, too. Plus, they look awesome.
We personally use Roosties, and we're huge fans. So if you're raising chicks or keeping chickens, check out the Roosties store on Amazon or follow the link in our show notes.
UK chicken lovers, this one's for you. Get happy, healthy hens with EcoNourish's live calci worms. Enrichment, nutrition, and protection in one tasty, sustainable pack. Scientifically proven to support glossy feathers, strong laying and skeletal health,
protect from disease, and improve gut health and immunity. You'll also bust flock stress by stimulating natural instincts and get eco bragging rights. Visit econourish.co.uk and use the code COFFEE15 for 15% off your first order. Your chickens and the planet will hug you for it. Hey, hey, chicken loving friends. Know why springtime is a super special fun time? Because it's chick season, and NatureWise wants to help you start your chicks off healthy and strong. So right now, you can try NatureWise Chick Starter Grower Feed and save $10. It's all the nutrition your little babies need in one feed. Click the link in our show notes to get $10 off from NatureWise today.
Okay, so let's move on to main topic. Yeah.
Yeah.
This week's main topic, we are welcoming Dr. Rebecca Gennaris back to our table, yay, to talk all about upper respiratory ailments. Enjoy. Okay, so we are so excited to welcome back Dr. Rebecca Gennaris to our table this week to, well, she can't drink coffee, but we can. She can drink decaf tea right now and talk about upper respiratory problems. Welcome back, Dr. Rebecca.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me back.
Of course.
It's always a pleasure, and we love sharing you with our listeners. So we want to talk to you today about respiratory problems. It's something that when it happens to one of your chickens, it's like big and scary, and a lot of people panic and don't know what to do. So we can talk about some of the most common problems, and then maybe some of the symptoms that if we see this particular symptom, it might be time to call the vet.
Yep, we'll definitely go through that, because I don't always think that every chicken with respiratory issues has to come in. And we have to remember that some of these chickens are getting viruses as well, and we don't have any real treatment for that. The only thing we would do for a chicken that has a virus is, if that chicken's really sick, like supportive care. But if the chickens in general, if they're able to still go about their day and are taking care of themselves, then in general, I don't necessarily think they have to be rushed in to figure out what's going on.
Okay, that's great to know.
So let's list the types of upper respiratory infections that they can potentially get.
So I would say in our area, at least, because I do send a lot of birds to either samples or unfortunately birds that have passed away off to our state lab to have them tested for respiratory diseases. I would say by far the most common that you're going to see in backyard flocks across the country is mycoplasma, whether that's mycoplasma, gallisepticum, or synoviae. They're basically just two different species, but they can cause essentially very similar symptoms. That by far is very common in backyard flocks. The other one I see very commonly is infectious bronchitis virus.
So how are your chickens going to get this? What is the way that they're going to contract this?
I mean, mycoplasma is, I would say, like rampant in backyard flocks in general. So, I mean, in general, the way that you're going to get mycoplasma, I can almost guarantee you're probably going to get it if you're bringing an adult bird from a different flock into your flock. If you don't know anything about like that flock's history, if they've never done any testing or anything like that. Mycoplasma, if you guys are familiar kind of with cats at all, so I think sometimes people also have cats and might be familiar with the upper respiratory infections that they get.
Yes.
They get herpes virus that essentially they get infected usually at the shelter just because it's, again, a virus that's rampant. They get infected and essentially they're infected for life once they have it. That's the same for mycoplasma. Now, the bird will not always be sick, but we can never get rid of the bacteria. So what will happen is the birds will get sick in times of stress. And one of the biggest times we see that is if you're introducing new birds into a flock, because anytime you're mixing birds, that's stressful for them. But you might see, if you have a flock with mycoplasma, you might see flares of respiratory issues during any times of stress. I mean, change of season, if you're changing anything about the coop in general. But I'd say the biggest thing is bringing birds into your flock. So I personally don't recommend, unless you know that flock's history, if they've been tested for mycoplasma, I don't recommend bringing adult birds from another flock into your own flock. That's the best way to make sure that your flock would get it if that's what you're doing.
We talk about it all the time with everyone, and we all have big hearts and we want to rescue chickens, but we've done multiple main topics about it. You have to be very careful when you rescue chickens because it's kind of different than a dog or a cat. You know, you can bring something in and it can affect and kill your entire flock. So you have to be aware. Now, they're past airborne, correct? So they can be carriers. And if they cough or sneeze or anything like that, then it's put into the environment that way.
Right. I mean, essentially, it's spread through what you would call respiratory droplets, which essentially become aerosolized. And the thing is, like, if you have testing done and you find at some point that your flock has mycoplasma, in a commercial setting, they would shut that flock down. But in a backyard setting, I mean, mycoplasma is not a death sentence by any means. It can cause recurrent respiratory issues. And if you're really relying on the eggs, and if you're hatching your own chicks, it will affect egg production and it will affect hatch rate. But in general, it is kind of like the common cold, I guess, in chickens. So, I mean, most of them do not die from this disease. Most of them will get sick, they'll get over it, and they will go on to be happy, healthy for a normal lifespan, I would say. So, if you already have mycoplasma in your flock, I mean, at that point, I would still use caution, but I would still think about quarantining birds. Most avian experts recommend, I would say, 21 days at a minimum. Most of them like to aim for 30 days to have that bird quarantined, because if they have mycoplasma, they're probably going to get sick in that time frame. And at least at that point, a bird that is actually having symptoms is going to spread it more than a bird that, even if it's a carrier, they're not going to spread it as much, if that makes sense.
You brought up an interesting point that egg production can be affected with birds who have this. So that might be something that if you're seeing you have a Leghorn or a Rhode Island Red and all of a sudden they're not producing eggs, this could be an underlying issue. They could be a carrier and it's affecting things that way.
Yes, absolutely. And it also affects, like I said, hatch rate. So if you're hatching your own chicks, if there's mycoplasma in your flocks, you have to kind of expect a lower hatch rate percentage than you would for a healthy flock.
How do you diagnose mycoplasma?
So mycoplasma generally has to be tested for. We have to specifically test for it. Luckily, here in the US, the state labs offer it at usually a pretty good price. And most of the time, we want to test birds that are kind of showing symptoms because we're more likely to actually get the organism on the swab. So basically, you would take your chicken. I don't know if it necessarily has to be to a vet, but someone that can do the respiratory testing in poultry, sometimes your state lab can actually come out to your flock and do it as well. And basically they would take a swab of the inside of the mouth of your chicken, specifically the trachea and the choanal slit in the top of their mouth. And they would take it back with them in a special broth and try basically test for mycoplasma to see if your flock has it or not.
Okay.
I mean, it's interesting stuff because sometimes people don't understand why their flocks have a failure to thrive. And this could be an underlying issue that's playing all along. Or a lot of people who rescue a lot of different chickens from different places, it's like playing Russian roulette. I hate to say it, but it really is at that point.
Yeah. Especially if your flock has never seen it before. If your flock is not positive for mycoplasma, then I would try by all means to keep it that way, because it, again, it's not a disease that can cause a lot of death, but it can cause issues just in general. And of course, if you have a chicken that's sick with something else, if they also have mycoplasma, then they're going to get much more sick if they have two diseases at the same time.
So how about the infectious bronchitis? Is that one that's easy to diagnose?
It's essentially the same. I will say a lot of state labs have actually a whole panel of diseases that they'll test for. So I know here in Maryland, if I am doing respiratory testing on a chicken, I send out for that panel. And what they test for is avian influenza and Newcastle disease, which are really, really, really terrible diseases. Hopefully we never pick those.
They're bad.
They're really bad. We don't have Newcastle as far as I know. I don't remember if and when the U.S. has ever had it, but that has been a long time. We have had reports, though, I'm sure people know, of the avian influenza in the area and in the country. So they'll test for that. They also test for infectious bronchitis virus. I usually have to add on mycoplasma, but I pretty much always do it because it's so common. And then they also test for a disease called infectious laryngotracheitis.
Yes.
That one's pretty uncommon. I don't see that one a lot. I've maybe seen it once.
What are the symptoms that we should be looking out for that our flock would be showing us if they have these things?
I would say, it, as a rule of thumb, most of these respiratory diseases can look very similar. There's obviously some things here and there that's going to make one different from another, that if they have that symptom might clue you in, but ultimately you'll have to test for it. But essentially, I mean, it can range anywhere from you might notice just a little bit more sneezing in your flock, or a little bit more coughing. I mean, it might be as mild as that, to the point where you might have chickens that are getting like discharge from their eyes. I also see some chickens where they'll get these really nasty abscesses around the eye, and it looks like the whole eye is swollen, and sometimes they can't open the eye. Wheezing, gasping, that open mouth breathing with like the neck extended. And then of course, if you're seeing things like if the comb is starting to look kind of muddy, or if you're having birds suddenly dying for no reason, those are much more concerning symptoms, obviously, that you should contact someone right away.
There's actually a vaccine for mycoplasma.
Yes.
How does the vaccine work? Is that something that you would give? Would it be like the Marek's disease where you vaccinate a bird for it and they can maybe still be carriers, but the symptoms won't manifest?
It's funny you brought this up because I actually just started looking into this. Admittedly, I don't know that much about it. I did talk to my friend that works in Virginia with poultry, and she said actually the vaccine there is prohibited for use. And I think it's something about, I think that they can't distinguish if you vaccinate a bird for mycoplasma, you can't vaccinate birds from birds that have been infected from like wild birds.
So it's a testing thing, kind of like with the avian flu. They're trying to do a vaccine, but once you have those titers, you always have them. So they can't determine if you have it or if it's just you have an immunity against
it. That's what it sounds like. It's something along those lines. So for whatever reason, it actually is not used at all in Virginia for reasons that like I'm not totally aware of. Sure. Because again, it's a commercial vaccine. Like I have no experience with it. But that being said, if they're not using it, I assume that it's not everything that we would want in a vaccine. So I don't see it used. I have never had anyone really ask for it. But it sounds like from what I've just talked about briefly with them, that that's not something that's really an option at this point for backyard flocks.
And then it's something, if it's a vaccine, do they have to get it at 1 day old before there's any exposure whatsoever? And then how, you know, like how would it work from that point?
That's a good question. I don't know the specific answer, but I would guess it's probably similar because just like Merrick's disease, mycoplasma is probably one of the most common issues that we see in chicken flocks in general. So I would assume that it would be something you would have to vaccinate them for before they're exposed to it. And how do you know if, because it's essentially out there. I mean, birds and stuff can carry it too.
So if you have it in your flock and you're hatching you have them.
So mycoplasma can be passed from the hen to the chick. So if you already have mycoplasma in your flock, when you're hatching eggs, those chicks will kind of already be carriers of it.
Wow. So just a little aside, because I was looking to see if Newcastle has ever been in Maryland, and I didn't find the answer to that. But what I did find is that the University of Maryland has been working on a vaccine for Newcastle disease.
Nice.
Oh, okay.
That's pretty nifty.
Yeah, Newcastle is really, really bad.
Yeah. I think, I mean, we've said this before when we've talked about rescues, bringing in rescues. Best case scenario there is that you have them quarantined on another property. And I know that's not easy for people, but that's just for the safety of your flock.
Agreed. And ideally, too, you should try to have them tested.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say quarantine and testing would be ideal. But no, it's tough because I wish I had an answer for these chickens that are showing up in rescues or the Humane Society. But truthfully, I don't think it's safe to adopt these chickens unless you know that they've been tested and that they've been quarantined for a specific amount of time.
You know, that's a really good practice to put out there, that if you're going to do a rescue, this is what we say, have a relationship with your own Dr. Rebecca, like we have a relationship with you, and you go get these animals and you make the appointment beforehand, you stop by the office, you get the test done, you quarantine them, and you kind of know what you're dealing with before anybody's affected any other way. In a perfect world, it's kind of how it would go down.
Or at right. the very least, check in with your state lab and see, you know, if you don't have a vet, check in with your state lab and see if they can do the testing.
Exactly. They right. might even be able to send you the swabs and the broth that the swabs need to be placed into. They might be able to allow you to test your own birds, essentially,
yeah.
too.
Yeah. I get it. We all want to rescue all the birds. But, I mean, our practice is we don't bring them in for a couple of months. I mean, we quarantine at a minimum of 60 days. To see yeah. any symptoms.
I think the longer the better, for sure.
Yeah.
If
yeah.
you have the facilities to do so. And of course, like mycoplasma aside, at least that's something we can test for and see if a right. bird starts showing symptoms for it. And I mean, Merrick's is still very scary too. I mean, that's another one that you don't want to bring into your flock. And unfortunately, we don't really have any testing for it before a bird shows symptoms at this time.
Yeah.
Okay. So someone has a chicken that's showing symptoms. They're not getting any better. We say at that point, we need some intervention. We need a doctor. Call the vet, go in. And then are there antibiotics that we use to treat, supportive care? Question.
I think something important to remember too is that we talk about these contagious respiratory diseases, but chickens can also get random organisms causing upper respiratory issues too. So, and that's especially like if you have one chicken that's affected, one or two. It might be just like you know how you might go to the doctor, you might have a cold, they test you for flu, they test you for COVID, and then it comes back negative. That doesn't mean, of course, that you don't have something, but right. they just don't know specifically what it is. So I think it's important to remember there are just other things out there too. I know like people read about things like fowl cholera, what is the other one? And coryrhiza are also ones that can cause upper respiratory things. Those are both bacteria, I'm pretty sure.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Both of those are bacteria.
Those are ugly too. Like when they manifest in a bird, it's not good.
Yes. Those can both be really ugly too. For some reason, I don't know if it's just ease of testing or what. I don't see that commonly on the respiratory panels. But I mean, luckily, those are ones that can be treated with antibiotics.
Oh, that's good to know.
So there are like a handful of ones that can be treated with antibiotics, but then we have the viruses that can't. But I mean, it doesn't matter to me either way sometimes because one, a virus can make them more prone to secondary bacterial infections. So if a bird is really sick, I will probably still do an antibiotic to make sure they're not going to get sick from something else on top of it. So the main things, like if I have a chicken that comes in with some sneezing and some coughing, but if their comb is nice and bright and I don't hear any weird lung sounds and they're for the most part still eating and drinking, maybe not quite as active. I mean, in general, probably just supportive care at that point, like electrolytes and vitamins in their water. I don't know that they necessarily need any prescription medications, but if I have a bird that comes in with really gross discharge from their nose, or if it's inside their mouth, or if they have really swollen sinuses, either within the mouth, or if we're seeing those really gross abscesses around the eye, at the very least, they could benefit from an anti-inflammatory just for comfort, just to help reduce that swelling. Some of these birds can also get something called aerosaculitis, which are essentially the bird respiratory system. They have a set of lungs like we do, but those lungs don't actually expand. The air goes through all these like air sacs that are in the bird's body, and the bird's air sacs can get inflamed. Kind of like if you think about like a pneumonia or bronchitis, some of those can be actually very painful in the chest. So for these birds, the air sacs can get inflamed. And I think, again, an anti-inflammatory can at least make them feel better while they're fighting off the virus or bacteria that they're dealing with.
The other thing's really good that you can do that is really hard to do kind of on your own is supportive care with sub-Q fluids. Now, here's the thing. Many years in an animal hospital, I worked 15 years. Sub-Q fluids are an amazing thing for animals who are dehydrated. And you can do this for chickens. You've done it for multiple of my chickens. You give them the fluids and it keeps them hydrated and keeps their body going in a time where they're needing to fight. Supportive care is huge.
Yeah, sometimes supportive care is, I would say, more important than even just reaching for antibiotics, because you're trying to support that bird the best they can while they're fighting this. And yeah, sub-Q fluids are an excellent way to support a bird if you have a vet that can do it for you, or potentially even show you how to do it at home. That is a great thing to do. I guess at the very least, doing the electrolytes and stuff in the water is also helpful, but it makes it so the bird doesn't have to like be drinking all the time, especially if they're not feeling well.
So I wanted to ask you this simply because it comes up so often, and you see this a lot in like online chicken groups. Someone puts up a photo of a bird and the bird is gasping.
Yeah.
I mean, like open mouth gasping. And 20 people will say that's gape worm.
Yeah. That's
and two great. People will say that could be allergies, that could be pneumonia, that could be a lot of things. Now, have you ever seen gape worm in a case?
I actually have not seen it. It doesn't mean that we couldn't at least deworm for it, but I don't think gape worm is nearly as frequent out in the wild as we think it is. I believe there's also some sort of either collaboration or study out there looking at like necropsy reports from state labs. And I don't think that there's ever been a clear case where like the cause of death was gape worm. It's usually like gape worm would be like a secondary thing that they might find, but it's not actually a main pathogen that's going to cause birds to get really sick.
And my understanding of gape worm, and I got this from our UK friends, gape worm is more common there because it's passed in pheasant feces.
And oh, in interesting. England, okay. Yeah.
And in England, you know, the UK, the pheasants are all over the fields, and then people free range their birds in the fields. There you go. But here, I've never known anyone personally who has had a case. I was just curious to see if you'd seen it.
I have not seen it yet, no.
Okay.
And the other thing is Safeguard does deworm for
it's going to cover gape worm.
Yeah. So, I mean, indirectly, if you think that there's some parasites going on, we always say Safeguard for goats. That's the way to go. It's a broad spectrum dewormer. It's going to cover that in case it's there anyway. So
when you see a bird who's doing that, when you see a bird that's gasping with the open mouth breathing, is that something that really should go to a veterinarian at that point?
I think yes, especially if it is not due to something like if you can identify that it's not because that bird is stressed at that period of time or overheated or something like more simple. If that bird is consistently doing that, and especially if you're noticing changes in the comb, then I do think that's something that warrants being seen, because we can also see other issues causing respiratory signs such as reproductive disease. If there's a lot of fluid in that bird's belly, they can act very much like a respiratory bird, even though that's not actually the problem.
Interesting.
That's why we always say check that vent area all the time in one of those 10-point checks, because the fluid, you'll feel it in the abdomen. It makes sense because everything's so compact in their body. It's pushing up on everything and it can't breathe. The other thing is a lot of people have honking and they say, okay, what is this? Can that be something as simple as dust in the nasal passage that they're trying to clear or be a problem?
That's what's also, I think, important to consider is that I would say, yes, we see respiratory diseases, but we also have to consider environmental issues. Chickens and birds in general have very, very finely developed respiratory systems. They're much more sensitive than we are to certain things. And things like fine particles, especially in the coop or the run area, can cause some of these guys to have respiratory irritation. I'd say the main one that I think more people are understanding now is like diatomaceous earth. I know is a very popular kind of natural antiparasitic that people use for dust bathing and stuff like that. But really, in general, if you're going to use it, you should really only use the food grade stuff and put it in the feed, because if they bathe in the diatomaceous earth, it's these very, very fine small particles and it can cause a lot of respiratory irritation.
That's good to know.
An example. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why ventilation and stuff in your coop too is really important, because they are very, I mean, chickens are very dusty, but you need to have adequate ventilation in your coop to make sure that it's not becoming an issue where they're re-inhaling it and getting irritated.
Yeah. It's kind of something that everyone, oh my goodness, we're having sneezing, honking. We go to this, it's got to be an upper respiratory infection. And we kind of forget there are many environmental factors that can cause this, right down to they get too much dust in their nasal passage and they got to clean it right. all out.
Exactly.
So giving them the time and the supportive care to kind of work through it a day or so and see what happens. The other thing is, we're going to put this out there. If your chicken's showing any upper respiratory problems, number one, we get this question, should I separate them? There is no question. Separate them at once, correct? Like take them out and separate them.
I guess for me, it depends on why are you separating them. If it's to give them care, supportive care, I think that, yes, I think that that is appropriate. If it's because you're worried about the other chickens getting it, I can guarantee you by the time, pretty much with any chicken disease, if one of them is showing symptoms, you taking that bird away from the rest of them doesn't mean you're saving the rest of the chickens. They've already been exposed.
They've already exposed.
I guess it's understanding why you would be separating them. It's not because you're preventing the other chickens from getting sick, because they've all been exposed to it already. It would be to give them supportive care and just take that stress off of them.
Exactly. I feel like once you take them out, the stress is off of that bird a little bit. To keep pretending that everything's okay, because we know that chickens are mean and they're going to try to kill the sick one. So
yes, exactly.
So yeah, taking them out, I feel like gives them a little bit more of a fighting chance. This is so much information. I really feel like this is so useful for our listeners.
I want to ask you one more thing about pneumonia. Because last year we saw a lot of people with cases of brooder pneumonia with chicks. And obviously, you know, a chick is a baby, their immune system's not fully developed. If you have a chick who is showing respiratory symptoms, what's the best course of action? Do you just observe them for a little while, or like your chick is gasping for air, you need to call a vet right away?
Chicks can go downhill so quickly. I think it's at least worth putting that call in if possible. Because again, just trying to get some of the supportive care can be helpful. So brooder pneumonia is usually and actually a fungal organism called aspergillosis. It's usually due to mold growth in the environment or like unsanitary conditions. So that's classically what brooder pneumonia is. It's not contagious is the thing. It's not contagious between the chicks. It's that the chicks would be getting it from the environment. So I think I've seen one case where I do really think it was brooder pneumonia, and I had to treat that chick with antifungals for it, and she did fine. But that's more, I guess, a prevention thing, if anything.
So I guess the takeaway there is don't leave your chicks with wet bedding.
Yes, I would say that's where, I mean, I know they're really dirty little creatures. The main thing is the wet bedding and stuff like that. You'd want to remove that because I know they'll spill their water and stuff sometimes. Yeah. It's not really like the droppings and everything that bother me. It's if there's stuff getting wet, you want to remove that.
And wet bedding, I mean, that also can let coccidiosis hatch, right?
Yes, I would say any like moist environments like that in general, you're going to grow things. So that can also could also lead to a coccidia issue. So just in general, just good hygiene with chicks, I think, is the most preventative thing that you can do. And I mean, of course, if you see a chick that's looking that sick, it's good to try to get vet care. But I would say on both ends there, if you have a chick that's acting that sick, they can go downhill so quickly. I would not fault anyone rather the owner or the vet if that chick ended up not making it, just because they can be so hard to bring back once they get sick.
Sure. And that's where that supportive care is 1,000,000% showing itself. And we always talk about Polyvisol and the extra vitamins for the chicks, the having the powder to liquid food on hand so that you can quickly give them something to support them through it. I feel like if you're going to get chicks, that's the stuff that you should always have on hand. Those two things, especially. And even like Oxbow, you can get over the counter now, you know, powder to liquid food, right, so that you can do that supportive care.
Separating and observing a bird with a respiratory issue is probably okay to do. But if you have a chick showing symptoms and you can get them to the vet, that might be the best course of action there.
Yeah, they don't have as much time usually as our adults, obviously.
I mean, that's good to know, especially I feel like our folks who are just getting their chicks this year and they're trying to learn everything. It's nice to give them a solid course of action.
Right.
You're so helpful all the time, Dr. Rebecca. We have so many people that want their own Dr. Rebecca.
Oh, that's sweet. I know. I wish that I could take care of everyone's chickens, but hopefully there will be more vets out there willing to learn about chickens and treat them appropriately.
You are amazing.
I can touch on two other things really quick. I know I talked about the eye abscesses. So that's like when your chicken's eye is really, really swollen. It looks like it's the eye sometimes, but it's usually the sinuses around it. While a lot of times I'll try to treat those chickens with medicine, be prepared that sometimes we actually have to open up that abscess and clean it out. So that's something that vets have to do sometimes. And that's something I always do under either sedation or anesthesia, just because it's right next to the eye. You want the bird to be nice and still. And of course, I'm sure it's painful too.
Yeah.
So that's something I don't recommend trying to do at home. It's not like an abscess in a cat or a dog or even a person where if you just poke it, like you'll get liquid that comes out. Usually it's this very firm, we call it caseous material. So you actually have to really like do a lot of flushing and more involved debridement than just poking a hole and flushing it out.
It's kind of like Bumblefoot. It's the same way. It's the chicken survival mechanism into encasing an infection from going further into other places. It solidifies it almost like the bumblefoot. It makes it like hard. It's different than other animals.
Yes, it's exactly the same process. Birds, they make that caseous material versus the liquid. That's just what bird species do.
Interesting. That's really fascinating.
And then I know something that has been, I guess, a hot topic in the past year is that removing some of those antibiotics from the feed stores. I know Tylosin was one of them. So Tylosin is an antibiotic that is approved for use for mycoplasma. So basically it is a powder typically that you mix in the water and it's approved for the use of mycoplasma. Now, that being said, I know a lot of people are upset that this got taken off the over-the-counter market as prescription now. And I mean, I think the reason is because it's really only good for mycoplasma or potentially other bacteria sensitive to it. It's not going to treat viruses. And it's also not treating mycoplasma in the sense that it's going to make the chickens free of mycoplasma. It's just treating the symptoms. It's just trying to make the symptoms less severe for the chickens. So really, we want to be using that in a setting where we know it's appropriate. If we know that the flock has been diagnosed with mycoplasma before, like if I have a mycoplasma positive flock that I've been working with, then if they have a flare up, I feel comfortable reaching for that. But if I have a random new flock, I don't always know that that's the best thing to give them. So that's approved for use for mycoplasma. But I will say, I don't think it's the best for chickens that are really sick, because if they're not drinking the normal amount that they're supposed to be drinking, they're not going to get the dose that they need. And I think most of those chickens need actually individual care rather than a water-based antibiotic.
Agreed.
Yeah,
agreed. I mean, there's something to say with dosing an animal individually versus just putting it in the water and hoping that they get what they're supposed to get. Exactly. So, you know, going to your veterinarian and getting exactly the right dosing, the tools to give it, we know that it's going to work versus kind of like flying out with a hope and a prayer. I put it in the water and if they don't drink, they're not going to get it. So that's a really good point that everyone needs to understand it. It doesn't make it go away. It's going to treat symptoms. Nothing's going to make it go away once they have it.
Yes, unfortunately, that is the case.
Wow. You have given us so much really, really good information today. As always, you are amazing. You're such a gem. And We do love you. You're doing so much good for chickens out there. And hopefully, you know, more veterinarians will get on board with learning all these things and help the backyard flock owners, you know?
I have one more question and Chris is going to yell at me when I ask it.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Here we go. I already know this.
How much do you see respiratory problems in waterfowl?
Of course, we're going to go waterfowl now. That's what we're going to do.
I will say waterfowl in general, I don't see a lot of problems, period. I see waterfowl much less than chickens. That being said, I have occasionally seen waterfowl come in with like the bubbly discharge from the eyes or swelling of the sinuses. So it does happen. I have seen them for that before.
Here's my question. If you have waterfowl and they're out, right, they're on a pond or whatever, are they carriers and do they bring it back? They don't have it, but they carry kind of like avian influenza.
Oh, I see where you guys are going with this. So in general, especially if we're talking about avian flu, then waterfowl tend to be carriers of it. They don't tend to actually show any symptoms of it. Now, I went to a conference recently and they said there has occasionally now been strains reported where it's almost like the opposite, where the waterfowl actually get really sick and the chickens don't, but that's pretty uncommon. So it's not like 100% sure thing, but in general, waterfowl tend to be carriers of avian influenza and won't show any symptoms of it.
So it's something to watch out for. If you have waterfowl, know that they can bring something back to your chickens without even your chickens leaving. So having them in a good area where they're not getting into trouble is also a good thing.
The biggest thing is preventing access to areas where wild waterfowl would be. And that would be like communal ponds and stuff like that. You don't really want your waterfowl mixing with those waterfowl because they're probably bringing avian influenza through that area.
Plus, they kind of have wild parties and stuff. So you don't want them partying that way.
That's true. So waterfowl can get mycoplasma like chickens can, and they can show symptoms from it. But avian flu is the main one that they may not show symptoms with.
Well, if Holly has her way, waterfowl is going to explode. Like everybody and their brother, their aunt, their grandma are going to have geese.
Or ducks. Holly
wants everybody to have them.
I do.
Well, we know that. We know that you want everybody to have them.
I will never have them. Sorry.
That's okay.
They're too messy. They're too much extra work.
They really are. I mean, you've got to know what you're getting into if you're going to get them. Absolutely. Yeah.
I have a lot of fun seeing them, but I don't personally feel like I need them here just because it is a different ballgame. It's not the same.
It's a complete different ballgame.
Well, Holly's three babies will be your patients.
Yes, they will.
So you will see them.
We have designed the run literally so it's on the edge of the property where it's a gentle slope down to the compost pile. So we can just flip the tubs, give them a scrub, and you know, refill it like three times a day. Otherwise, you're going to have swamp.
Yes, exactly. You have to have a strategy.
Yeah, you do. Well, this really has been wonderful. We get so many questions about respiratory problems. It's very scary for chicken keepers, and there's so much misinformation. So hopefully this answers some questions and gives people a plan of action.
Definitely. And like I said, I can't say it enough, Rebecca, you are amazing. Thank you for doing all that you do for the poultry world, because there needs to be a million more vets like you out there that want to learn as you go and learn these things and help the backyard flock owners, because we need the help. We do.
I know. It's definitely a need out there. Thank you for saying that. And thank you guys also for doing what you guys do and trying to spread awareness to other backyard chicken owners and evidence-based information.
We try. Sometimes we feel like we're pushing a boulder up a really steep hill, but you know, if together, I'm sure you probably feel this way too. If you help two chickens, then you've helped two chickens and their people. And that's a good thing.
Exactly. No, I agree. That's definitely a good perspective to have.
Definitely. So I don't know. This might be the last time for just a few months that we have Dr. Rebecca on, because she's going to be giving birth soon to a second little baby boy.
That's right. In April.
Wow. And we already got the email about the maternity leave and we're like,
I think it touched off a panic in Northern Maryland. Everyone was like, oh, no, Dr. Rebecca.
Get your birds. Get your birds into Pleasantville.
I see parrots, too. So it does feel like all the bird people are coming in these last few weeks.
You're indispensable.
You are. And they're like, Dr. Rebecca's going to have another baby. We're like, oh, God, everybody brace for the next 3 months.
Hopefully it'll go by quick and hopefully nothing bad will happen while I'm gone. But I mean, my staff is pretty well versed in especially poultry at this point, that they can relay stuff to me if they feel like it needs to be done.
Your staff is amazing. I love the girls that work with you. I love them.
I will also say, and this really impressed me, when your staff sent out the email that you were going to be out on maternity leave, they gave a long list of other vets in Maryland and Pennsylvania.
I saw that and I was actually very impressed too, because I actually didn't know a lot of the places on there. So yeah, they definitely tried to reach out and find a lot of people that are somewhat manageable to travel to if possible.
That's fantastic. It goes a long way towards calming racing hearts when they think you're not going to be around for a while. Yeah.
Right. And these two racing hearts. Racing hearts right here, Holly and I. Ours are like beating a mile a minute. We're like, no.
Your chickens just had to stay out of trouble.
Exactly. We had to go out there and tell them. Dr. Rebecca's on vacation.
Let them know.
Dr. Rebecca's having a baby now. You be good for the next 3 months, okay?
Hopefully they can manage.
Okay. Well, thank you so much again. I'm sure our listeners, this is invaluable information. Definitely.
Yeah, and if there's more specific questions, we could always touch on that later. Respiratory disease in general is a very big topic, so I understand it can be a little overwhelming, and we can always circle back and address some things more specifically if needed.
Great, great. Thank you.
Sounds good. We'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. We just want to thank Dr. Rebecca one more time for spending a fantastic hour with us. We hope that was a really valuable talk for a lot of people.
Oh my goodness, so much information that you can learn from her. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us about this, Dr. Rebecca. Okay, are we ready to move on to
cracking the eggs?
Cracking those eggs. Now, we're kind of sticking with brunch because it's the brunch time of the year.
It's brunch season.
It's brunch season because the spring is all about, hey, using your eggs all the time. So let's just make breakfast and lunch one meal. And so this recipe is another way to do it. We're talking buckwheat pancakes with oven roasted apples. Can you go wrong with this?
It's so good. Now, buckwheat, if you're not familiar with buckwheat, it's an ancient grain that's been in cultivation in Asia for about 5,000 years. It is naturally gluten-free. It is low to medium on the glycemic index if you're watching your blood sugar. And it adds a nutty flavor to pancakes and crepes and any other place that you want to use it. And that nutty flavor goes particularly well with apples.
Oh, everything goes well with apples. I love me some apples.
Why are you making fun of my apple trees then?
Because I haven't gotten any apple trees yet, man.
They're 2 years old. What do you want?
One apple
worker. No, you want apple. Okay.
Okay. So let's go through the ingredients of the pancake batter. 1 cup of that buckwheat flour. 1 cup of all-purpose flour or gluten-free all-purpose flour, 1/3 cup of granulated sugar, 1.5 teaspoons of baking powder, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of baking soda, grated zest from 1 lemon, 2 eggs. Here's our eggs getting in there. 1 cup of buttermilk or dairy-free buttermilk, 1 cup of whole milk or dairy-free or plant-based milk, 2 tablespoons of olive oil or canola oil.
You're going to grab yourself a large mixing bowl. You're going to put the flour, both flours, the sugar and the baking powder, salt, baking soda, and the optional lemon zest in a large bowl. Whisk that really well to combine. Grab a medium bowl. You're going to crack your eggs into it and whisk them. Then you're going to stir in the buttermilk, the milk, and the oil. Whisk it all together till it's smooth. Grab your dry ingredient bowl. Make a well in the middle of that.
It's a pretty standard practice for all this stuff.
It really is, yeah. Pour the wet ingredients in there, and you're going to mix until it's completely blended. You want to heat a heavy skillet or a griddle, whatever you usually use to make pancakes. Get that nice and hot over medium-high heat. You want to lightly butter or spray the surface of the pan with oil. Ladle about 1/4 cup of batter into the griddle, however many pancakes fit in there. You can use your usual routine for pancake making with this recipe.
Exactly.
You're going to cook for like 2 minutes until the edges of the pancakes are starting to look golden and you're starting to see bubbles form. Flip them over, cook the second side for 1 minute or so. Really, even though this is buckwheat, you cook it exactly the same way you would cook all the other pancakes you ever make.
Okay, so let's move on to the oven roasted apples, because this is really my favorite part of the recipe, because, you know, I love apples, right? So let's go with 5 to 6 medium apples peeled and cut into chunks. They're also good unpeeled and have more fiber. Now,
I'm lazy. I don't even peel them.
I don't know why you need to take the peels off. They're edible. They're the really nutritious part of the apple anyway. So yep. Leave them on if you can.
Yeah.
Okay, 2 tablespoons of butter or dairy-free butter cut into small chunks, 2 tablespoons of brown sugar, and 1 teaspoon of cinnamon. Love that spice.
Oh, it smells so good when this is baking. Preheat your oven to 350. You're going to put the apples in a small to medium baking dish that's been greased or sprayed to prevent some of the sticking. Dot the apples with the small chunks of butter, then sprinkle the cinnamon and sugar over top. Pop that into the preheated oven until the apples are soft. It's going to take about 20 to 30 minutes, depending on how hot your oven runs.
And you're done. I mean, the thing is, this baked apples, you can do it for anything. If you just have a few apples and you want a little dessert, you can eat it by itself. A lot of people serve this as a side at dinner.
Yeah.
That it's very easy. You can put it on top of your pancakes or just eat them as they are.
I love these apples with those buckwheat pancakes. It is delicious.
So serve it at your brunch. Let us know what you think. Send us some pictures. We would love to see them. Okay, so let's move on to retail therapy. Retail therapy. Yeah. This week's retail therapy, we're talking about a company that's out there now called Hengear. And Hengear makes nest boxes.
They do. They make large farm scale equipment. They sent us one of their medium nest boxes.
And I have it over on my homestead. We're going to put up some videos for it. It's basically a portable nest box. Now, they do have where the eggs all roll down to the front so that, you know, basically you could just collect the eggs at the bottom. They're not staying up where the chickens lay them. They're kind of rolling down to the end.
A nest box like that, you might have to work a little bit to integrate it into your setup, but that's a really good solution if you have egg eaters.
Or if you have fighting over nest box and you want to add extra nest box, These portable nest boxes, you can just add, but they're actually like a structure. So it's not just like a kitty litter pan that you put in. Right. It's a legit structure to put into your run.
It's a big network. It's heavy. They're steel. When we say portable nest box, we don't mean portable like you're going to pick up one or two and move them.
Right.
I mean, like, it's a unit of nest boxes.
It's a structure. And they are, again, there's so many uses for them. Especially if you have a lot of nest box fighting, like you said, egg eaters, all these different things, they're a good solution.
You can actually find a way to work this nest box into your setup where the eggs roll out and you can collect them outside of the run without even having to walk into the run. Like for biosecurity reasons, or if you have kids who like to collect them. We also think they would be really great if you were setting up a coop and it's sort of like an adapted shed.
Right.
So it's just a square structure. You could use these nest boxes as your primary nest boxes. Just fit them inside the shed.
Yeah, you can go on their socials or on their website, and they do show, like, some people, they actually legit cut the side of their run out for the nest boxes. So you don't even have to go in the run to get them. When we were at Cooptastic, this kind of came up multiple times of being able to collect eggs without going in, like for children, young children who wanted to collect eggs.
Right.
Or if you have family or friends that want to visit your chickens and collect eggs, but they're afraid to go in. These types of things, they seem to work really well. Now, and they're very strong. It's a great structure. And it's, like I said, it's not anything, you know, like a little litter box. It's a nice thing that you're going to put in your run.
Yeah, they're big and they're hefty and they're sturdy. And I would imagine they would last for a long, long, long time.
They will last, it looks like, forever.
Yeah.
So it's a really great product. They have waterers and feeders on their website. They have different things. What I found was really interesting is they have the big setups for chickens on pastures.
Uh-huh.
that you could buy for $20,000.
So this is like if you're a pastured poultry farmer.
Yeah.
This is the kind of equipment that you would use. I mean, like we said, a lot of their products are very big farm oriented. I think they're probably a great solution for agricultural setup.
So nice. So nicely made. They have egg trays, egg cart, egg crates, everything that you need over there. So check out Hen Gear. See if there's anything over there you might like. And cool. The stuff is so nicely made. You won't be disappointed.
We have them linked in the show notes.
Okay. So should we tell everybody what we're going to be talking about next week?
Oh, next week is wonderful. We are spotlighting the beautiful Welsh Harlequin duck.
It always makes Holly happy to do ducks.
Yeah. Main topic, we have an interview. You don't want to miss this story. We have an interview with Amy, the founder of the Good Egg Company. Her story will touch you. The products are fantastic. Tune in next week. You're going to love her as much as we did.
You do not want to miss this interview. It's amazing.
Cracking the eggs. This recipe works with chicken, duck, or goose eggs. This is new potato and egg salad on greens.
Yummy. Yeah.
And retail therapy, this is a little fun. We're going over to the shop of our friend Stephanie Turow from Minnesota From Scratch. You might know her for her homesteading books. She makes absolutely beautiful hand-stamped metal jewelry. It's gorgeous stuff.
You will not want to miss this. Okay, so what should we tell everybody to do until next week?
Hug your Fayumis. Ha ha ha, just kidding. Hug your chickens.
Every day and kiss them too. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to see more of us, please follow us on Instagram at Coffee with the Chicken Ladies. If you'd like to help us grow the podcast, please leave us a written review on Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to become a patron of the show, please visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/coffeewiththechickenladies. Thanks for listening. Ha 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 ha!